You're listening to the Mind Over Murder podcast.
My name is Bill Thomas. I'm a writer, consulting producer, and now podcaster. I am now trying to use my experience as the brother of a murder victim to help other victims of violent crime. I'm working on a book on the unsolved Colonial Parkway murders, and I'm the co-administrator of the Colonial Parkway Murders Facebook group together with Kristen Dilley.
My name is Kristen Dilley. I'm a writer, a researcher, a teacher, and a victims advocate, as well as the social media manager and co-administrator for the Colonial Parkway Murders Facebook page with my partner in crime, Bill Thomas. Welcome to Mind Over Murder. I'm Kristen Dilley.
That makes me Bill Thomas.
We would love to give a shout out to our friend and yours, Cheryl McCollum, and the crew at CSI Atlanta for their Emmy win. Way to go.
Congratulations, Mac and team. We just think it's great that you let us hang out with you, and we want to come over at some point, you know, when we can travel, and touch your Emmy, which are really big and have big pointy things at the top. I've seen them in person before.
We are absolutely thrilled for Mac because she has put so much of her heart and soul into doing all of this work with CSI Atlanta. We are so glad to see that paying off. Mac, congratulations. We are so proud of you.
Yes, we are. And she's off doing new cases, and she's going to help solve other unsolved cases in the South and throughout the entire country. So it couldn't happen to a greater detective or a nicer team of people.
Absolutely.
Speaking of crime, we've finalized our plans to attend CrimeCon, which is now in Austin, Texas, in 2021. Our dates are June 4th through the 6th. Kristen is very excited about this. She's well ahead of me in the paperwork department. No surprise there. I have to actually transfer my tickets for CrimeCon Orlando, which is sadly no more, to get ready for Austin. We're very excited about it, and hopefully we will see many of you there next June in beautiful Austin, Texas.
Yeah, we love CrimeCon. We have gone, I think, twice now, Nashville and New Orleans.
Yes, ma'am.
And we had a blast every time, and we have loved getting to meet people and hang out with our own favorite podcasters, and it's going to be a blast. So if you can join us in Austin, we would love to see you. We'll be on Podcast Row. Come hang out. Say hello.
It's going to be fantastic.
All right. We would also like to encourage you to please take a couple of minutes out of your very, very busy schedule and make sure that you give us a 5-star rating or review, preferably both, on your preferred podcast platform, because we can always use your help in helping to grow our audience.
Just remember, dipsticks will always write a review, so we need good reviews from you guys to offset the dipstick reviews. Every once in a while, we'll get like a bizarre review, and we both look at each other, and of course, you can't respond to them. And other more experienced podcasters have said, Kristen, Bill, don't read your reviews. Kristen skips them, but I actually read them because I'm a glutton for punishment. Many of the reviews have been very, very kind. We very much appreciate it. If you've got good things to say, especially, jump in there, give us a 5-star review, and tell people why you enjoy Mind Over Murder.
We would like to acknowledge a very sad anniversary this weekend as part of the Colonial Parkway murders. We would like to acknowledge the lives and the spirits of Robin Edwards and David Nobling, who disappeared on September the 20th from the Ragged Island Wildlife Preserve in 1987. Their bodies were found 3 days later on September the 23rd.
It's amazing to us that 33 years have gone by and their case remains unsolved as part of the Colonial Parkway murders. This time of year, we have 3 of the 4 anniversaries in the Colonial Parkway murders series happened in the same 6-week time frame. And so we're kind of right in the middle of it. We wanted to let Robin and David's families know we were thinking of them. As always, we'll be working together to try to solve these cases and bring some degree of closure to all of us as families who have lost loved ones.
We are looking forward to presenting to you part 4 of our series on the Donna Hall Mike Margaret murders from 1984 in Henrico, Virginia. We are concluding with Blue Hall, our resident expert on the murders. And we are looking forward, and hope you are too, to a very interesting and possibly inflammatory episode.
Blue Hall is naming names and identifying suspects. We're going to have an extra special guest the following week, and we'll tell you more about that later.
Thank you so much for listening to Mind Over Murder. We hope to see you next time. Welcome to Mind Over Murder. I'm Kristen Dilley.
And I'm Bill Thomas.
And we are back with Blue Hall, co-administrator of the Justice for Mike Margaret and Donna Hall Facebook page. Thank you for joining us again, Blue.
Oh, glad to be back.
So when we left off last time, we were talking a little bit about Donna Hall and her possible drug connections. And you had mentioned a transaction that Donna had arranged that you wanted to go into in a little bit more detail. So why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit more?
Yeah, so in our quest for information, we discovered somebody that was in town. This guy was from out of town. He was a friend of the guy we're calling Freckles. They went to Fork Union Military Academy together.
Okay.
And he wasn't well known by anybody in those circles. And police had already interviewed him at that point. He was probably the first guy they brought in after our Facebook group got started. I had promised the investigators that I would not divulge this guy's name publicly, I think because they believed he had information that could help solve this case. All right, so I agreed. And, you know, 2-3 years went by, and we kept this guy's name off our page, never came up. No, but nobody really knows who he is. So at one point, I got frustrated with the state lab and, you know, the whole process. So I reached out to this guy's wife, who was on Facebook, and I sent her a private message, and I said, you know, you don't know me, and I, you know, pardon the intrusion into your life, but I think your husband may have information that could help us solve the murder of my classmate and her boyfriend. And I gave her my phone number. You know, I said, you know, if you're uncomfortable passing this along to your husband, you can call me anytime. And so I heard nothing, you know, for about a week. And then I got a phone call from a Richmond, Virginia number that I did not recognize. And I answered it. And it was this guy. I guess we'll call him the out-of-towner.
Okay.
And he offered to explain everything he did that night to the best of his recollection.
To you directly?
To me, directly. And we know for a fact he was hanging out with Freckles. I knew that prior to this phone call. He confirmed that. He also explained his relationship with the rapist, Neil Foreman, and how he's completely frightened of the guy and how crazy he was. He explained to me that him and Freckles were in Donna's apartment that night. This was a big one for me because I didn't know if he had told investigators that or not. You know, they're not going to tell. Police have told me nothing, you know. So, of course, I get on the horn right away, you know, after that call, and I call the police and, you know, tell them everything. I've heard nothing about it since. You know, I know they interviewed Freckles after that about break-ins, you know, part of the midget squad and all that, and he confessed to raiding refrigerators or whatnot, but this guy, the out-of-towner, told me, you know, he and Freckles sold Donna a small bag of marijuana early that evening. I don't know about what time, you know, he didn't tell me, but Donna had arranged a drug buy for them. They were looking for harder drugs, cocaine, and I believe they went across the river, got some cocaine, and they partied with Neil Foreman at his home with the two of the girls that Donna was with in her car earlier, and another guy who ended up, that other guy, you know, got dropped off at a bar and spent the night in Richmond City Jail. So he's been pretty much eliminated as a suspect.
And when you talk about across the river, what river are we talking about, and where does that take you in terms of towns or what have you?
Yeah, across the river means into the south side of Richmond or Chesterfield County.
Got it.
It's all part of the major Richmond metropolitan area.
Right, and this is where Floorman lived at that time?
No, he lived on the north side of the river. He was probably just a couple miles. His home was just a couple miles away from the murder scene.
Mm-hmm. you have a group of people partying with Neil Florman and engaged in a drug deal on the south side of town?
Yeah, I don't know if Florman was a part of that drug deal.
Got it. So
I do know drugs were acquired and ended up at the Florman home. And I can just speculate that, you know, they ran out of drugs and were looking for more. You know, I'm going to assume those two girls knew Donna had money and was looking to buy a large amount of drugs. Did they end up back at King's Crossing Apartments? Did something go wrong there? I don't know. I think it's worth looking into. And I think the out-of-towner, this guy, is willing to talk. He's just frightened. He needs to tell us what he knows publicly. Let's get the conversation started.
And even with Neil Florman currently incarcerated for the Florida rape, this guy's still afraid of Neil Florman?
Yeah, I've only talked to him once. It's been a couple of years now, so I just assumed he is.
That's very interesting. And by the way, you referenced something that's worth revisiting briefly, Blue, which is we share your frustration with the communication with law enforcement is often very one-sided. I think your experience probably will line up with mine. They will pump you for everything you know, but won't tell you very much and certainly rarely confirm information that you've received. Have you had a similar experience?
Yeah, but I think that's fair. I mean, that's their job is to get information. At a certain point, are they responsible for telling victims' families detailed information? You know, I don't know. Our job is just to give the police the information. That's their job.
Right.
Right. We're not trying to play, you know, armchair detective here. Although at times we do find ourselves in that role.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Or we feel like that. You know, but that's not what we want. We don't want to step on law enforcement toes either. That's, you know, they asked me not to divulge this guy's name. I'm not going to do it.
Oh, I understand. Where I found frustration at times, and Kristen's aware of this, is when I provided information to law enforcement, whether it's Virginia State Police, FBI, or whomever, I'd like to get some sense of whether or not it was followed up upon. I understand these folks, they don't answer to me as a family member of a murder victim or anyone else, you as the friend of a murder victim. All three of us on this podcast are wearing the advocate hat of some sort. I get that law enforcement doesn't answer to us, far from it. Ultimately, it doesn't matter if we think we've solved a case or whatever. I put air quotes around that. What matters is, can law enforcement solve a case and then can they move it towards something that's actionable that could result in an arrest, an indictment, a conviction, and surviving appeals? That's ultimately what investigators and then prosecutors are looking to do. And they have to run this process. But particularly when we're talking about cases that get so drawn out, 3 decades, a lot of balls get dropped. And
yeah, I agree. It's frustrating. It would be awesome to know if they followed up on this, you know, or not. You know, they've already interviewed the guy. I do know that. He told me that, this guy who called me the out-of-towner. Did he tell the police the exact same thing he told me? I don't know. Isn't that enough for a grand jury to be convened? Let's see what these guys told who and when. Let's see if they can turn on each other. Let's, you know, call me as a witness. You know, I'll testify what this guy told me.
Well, and I get your frustration. And you didn't even reach out to the out-of-towner, and I do like the nickname, until there had been some substantial delay from when his name first came up to, you know, you reached out to him through his wife on social media. Am I following you correctly?
Yes.
So at that point, you had let what, months or even years go by, and I think you were fairly patient.
I believe I was patient, yes.
So what is the current status of the case right at the moment? Can you give us some information about that?
I can, to the best of my knowledge, the case is still an open cold case. It's at the top of the list of the cold case unit. Now, having said that, I don't believe there is a full-time detective working cold case. I believe there's at least one, maybe two retired police that come in and go through those files, you know, without full badge power, if you will. I don't think they're allowed to go out into the streets and interview people. They sit there essentially tied to a desk and, you know, take phone calls and look through files. I don't think that's good enough. I think they need somebody full-time in there. And, you know, one of the biggest hindrances to cold cases is when they have detectives working active cases at the same time they're working cold cases. It's just not efficient. You got to focus on these cold cases, right? Do you agree?
Well,
absolutely.
Completely, yes. And we've seen the same thing in our case, both with the Virginia State Police and the FBI. When did Detective Holsinger retire and move on? Approximately how far back is that?
Oh, gosh, I'm so bad with time. It's been probably a year at least.
I was thinking it's between 1 and 2 years. So,
yeah, something like that.
Since Holsinger moved on.
Yeah. And he, you know, I'm sure he still talks to those guys. You know, they're friends. You know, they work together for years. They're just not going to cut ties. But, you know, Thomas had a vested interest in solving this case. You know, he was a classmate of Mike's. And, you know, Thomas was great. You know, he gave us his personal cell phone number. And I can't tell you how many times I came across a piece of information when I was back there. You know, I was going through court records. I was going through the public library when I was there. Came across something just like wow factors, right? And I'd call him up at, you know, 5, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night, and he was there for us, right? He was just fantastic. And I just don't get the same level of enthusiasm right now. Just, you know, there's nobody in cold case except maybe a retired detective.
So. Right. And in some cases, the retired detectives aren't even doing this work full time. They come in
a
couple of days a week or what have you. What are your hopes for your 3,000-plus member Facebook group and the admins? What are you hoping to achieve going forward?
Well, obviously, ultimately, for this case to be solved, whether it be with the help of this Facebook group or the police working on their own or any combination of those two, you know, I feel in my bones this case is solvable, and I see it being solved and there being a huge party and me flying back to Virginia and just giving those detectives a big hug and high fives, you know, high fiving Scott Margaret, you know, giving that guy a big hug and Allison and, you know, all Donna's friends, you know, gives me goosebumps thinking about it. I think it's very doable. You know, there's things working against this case, right? You know, their bodies sat out in the elements, you know, torrential rains, just brutal heat, humidity for 3 or 4 days, you know, before they were found. So, you know, physical evidence had already started deteriorating, you know, mm-hmm. including the blood, you know, the fact that third party blood in the Jeep is gone. Once I discovered that, that really just depressed me, you know, honestly. So they need to, you know, they need to collect some new evidence, new samples from those victims' clothes.
Right.
And just hunt for third-party blood, get it tested, see what they can do with it.
As far as you know, they still have a significant amount of evidence. It may be deteriorated, but they still have the clothes. Do you know if they have interior parts from the Jeep
or the luggage? I think they have all that. I think they cut out samples, you know, of where there was blood spatter, you know, the vinyl in the Jeep. Seat vinyl, you know, wherever there was blood. I think all that's intact. Mm-hmm. It's pretty well preserved considering, you know, the age of it.
Right. And the vehicle itself, the Jeep, was disposed of at some point?
I think, you know, the Margarets had kept the Jeep at their home for a number of years. I think Scott probably used it at one point when, you know, he went off to college. But I think they ultimately sold it.
And the murder itself had not necessarily taken place inside the car, correct?
I don't think it was inside the car. I think there'd be a lot more blood inside that Jeep if there was.
Yeah, it's funny. This was such an odd thing in the Colonial Parkway murders. In, I think, 3 of the 4 examples, everyone except for Kathy and Becky's case, my sister Kathy's case, the first of the double homicides, they took the, I don't know, for me, the odd step of returning the car to the families. And the families didn't quite know what to do with the car. Now, except in Kathy and Becky's case where there was a significant amount of blood inside the car and the bodies had been placed inside the car without getting too graphic. Mm-hmm. In the other examples, the families like just didn't know what to do with the vehicles. Mm-hmm. It saddened them to have the vehicles around, so they ultimately sold the vehicles just to get rid of them, just because it, can you imagine the car your brother or sister was driving the night they went missing or were murdered? Sitting in your in your garage or your driveway?
Yeah, I can't imagine. I think the fact that, you know, they weren't murdered and that Jeep made it easier for them to hold on to it and for Scott to use it. You know, that Mike loved that supposedly. And so just hanging on to something that was close to his brother maybe gave him some comfort and connection. You know, but you'd have to talk to Scott about that.
Yeah. It's... One of the most frequent questions we're asked here at Mind Over Murder is, how can I help?
Thanks to Othram, a leading forensic DNA testing lab for law enforcement, you can get involved and help solve real cases.
If you have tested at a consumer genetics company, you can contribute your data to DNASolves.com. The process is easy and confidential, just two simple steps. Your DNA might be the missing piece that helps solve the identity of an unknown person.
Then Mind Over Murder will highlight cases Othram is working on to seek your crowdfunding support for DNA testing to help solve these cold cases.
Upload your DNA profile to DNASolves.com. It's easy, free, and confidential.
Then join Mind Over Murder as we help families find answers with Othram and DNASolves.com.
Thank you for supporting Crawl Space Media Podcasts. I'm here to tell you about LA Not So Confidential, the forensic psychology and true crime podcast brought to you by me, Dr. Shiloh, and this guy.
Hey, I'm her bestie and co-host, Dr. Scott. She was a cop and I was a Hollywood casting director. Now we're both forensic psychologists working in Los Angeles. Twice a month, we bring you a classic or contemporary true crime story. We apply the real psychological concepts behind the story and dish on the media's representations of those cases.
Subscribe now to LA
Not So
Confidential, wherever you get your Crawl Space Media podcasts. True crime, psychology, and snark.
Trust us, we're doctors.
Funny too, we did some research when we spoke about the Grateful Dead the other day and the potential connection. Your recollection is completely spot on. Richmond had been a regular tour stop for the Grateful Dead for a number of years. You know, they were touring a lot. And then those back-to-back shows in fall 84 and then fall 85.
That was the end of it.
That was the end of it. And so it's funny, I saw figures and the history of the Grateful Dead is available in incredible depth online because they've got, you know, this incredible fan base and this great connection with their fans. So the that drug crackdown that you talked about that happened in 1985 effectively ended the Grateful Dead's relationship with Richmond. And then the town, the city, actually made an effort to ban the Grateful Dead. And so they ended up continuing to play Virginia for decades after that. They never came back. And so they would play the other venues that you spoke about in Hampton and elsewhere. They weren't going to ignore their fans in Virginia, but they just stopped coming to Richmond.
Yep, that's true.
I told that to my brother yesterday, who is a Dead fan, and that just blew his mind. He was like, what?
There was a lot of coverage that I found, too. It's amazing how the town fathers, if you will, there were probably some mothers in there, but political leadership in Richmond wanted to push the Grateful Dead out of town, basically. And that insane drug crackdown. And they also, they claimed... And remember, law enforcement and political leaders, respectfully, have a lot of influence with local media. They reported that 200 plus fans rushed the doors at the show, and I'm not saying it didn't happen, but you know, there was a claim that there was a riot, and that, and again, Grateful Dead fans, it's a pretty mellow crowd, if you catch my drift. Their claim was that there was a riot basically, and that the fans rushed the doors and 200 plus people were arrested and all this stuff. And some of it, I thought, looked a little blown out of proportion. But the Grateful Dead were effectively banned in Richmond and stopped coming. And then they continued to tour extensively, and they always played Virginia markets, but they just never played Richmond again.
Yeah, honestly, I don't think the city even needed to enact that ban. The Grateful Dead weren't going to come back after that. It was pretty obvious. But an interesting little tidbit, somebody had told me either that fall of 84 or fall of 85, the Dead actually dedicated a song to Mike and Donna. So, you know, there's bootleg tapes available online. I tried to find it, but, you know, sitting through 3 or 4 hours of music, I could never find it. But it'd be interesting if somebody could find that and post it.
Well, it's interesting, again, not being a fan of the band, but I respect their relationship with their fans. And as we talked about previously, they did promote and allow and facilitated taping of the shows. You weren't supposed to sell them. You were then just supposed to trade them. And there was a whole big underground culture of Grateful Dead tape trading. But interestingly, that fall 85 show is considered a peak show of Grateful Dead at their best in their mid 80s sound. So that show is available online in its full duration versus other shows where sometimes, you know, they'll pick a couple of songs and that'll be on a compilation tape. Interestingly, that fall 85 show, their last show in Richmond, is available in its entirety for Grateful Dead collectors. I found that interesting. Sad that there's a potential tie-in with Donna and Mike's murder.
I think this is such an interesting example of a case where physical evidence isn't necessarily going to get us to the answer that is needed, but an understanding of the people involved, the culture of the time, the place where it took place. I can't think of a case where you really need to understand the people involved and the area that it was set in more than this one. I find this really, really fascinating. And everything that you've talked about on the site with the topic cards really underscores the fact that you have to understand a lot about the people who were involved with this to maybe come up with answers. I just find that really fascinating. This has been a very interesting way to approach this case.
Yeah, it just seems to me there's unanswered questions with a very small group of people that were in that area, that were relatively close to Donna and a little bit with Mike, that you think would be more than willing to talk, that you think they'd be the loudest vocal proponents to solve this murder, but they're being the quietest, the most hush-hush out of anybody, you know, and the ones that are, you know, at least two of those guys have threatened legal action. So, yeah, you know, they claim to have loved him and protected, but no, they're just not saying a word.
Is there any sense of what might drive that decision-making, in your opinion?
Yeah. They don't want to implicate themselves in either a murder or a cover-up. It's that simple. Or they don't want to jeopardize the life they've built since, right? Even though they may have had nothing to do with it, just participating in the conversation may draw attention to their current life.
Yeah, I find that fascinating. As we talked about, we're mostly talking about people that were in their late teens or early 20s 36 years ago. They're now in their 50s for the most part. It's funny, it feels like among a certain group of key players, there seems to be a significant effort, despite their declaration of love or fondness or friendship for one or both of these people, they seem to want to keep their distance, which makes me a bit sad that they aren't even willing to participate in the resolution of their friend's brutal murder.
Yeah. Oh, don't get me wrong. There are close friends of Donna's and Mike's especially that have been very outspoken you know, very forthcoming advocates to solve this murder. But that one group that was only moderately close to Donna and maybe Mike, I don't know, that are just being hush-hush. And those are the people with incredible criminal records since that happened. You know, guys that went on, you know, at least two of those guys had become informants for the police. You know, there was another guy. Let me just go. There was another guy. I'm going to call him Mushroom Boy. I reached out to him. You know, there was a rumor, you know, about a van with carpet being rolled up in it and set on fire that night of the murders, or the next night, or soon after the murders. I don't know when exactly it was. Yeah, there was a van that burned. Was there a knife in there? Was there, you know, evidence that was burned along with it? Or was there bloody carpet, you know, they were murdered on, ripped out from an apartment? You know, who knows? That did happen. We know who that guy was. I reached out to him, and he thought Donna and I were related, right, because of our last names. And he was willing to talk to me, and that we were emailing back and forth, right? And once he found out, you know, I said, well, Donna and I were not related. He ceased all communication with me. Said if I ever contacted him again, he's going to sue me. Yeah. So.
And yet, if we weren't related. If you were her brother, it would be okay. But since you were schoolmates, it wasn't.
Yeah. Yeah. It seemed he was willing to talk until he found out we weren't related, and you know, said, you know, I called him a coward at that point. And he said, don't ever contact me again. And you better hope I don't ever see you.
Wow. Boy, it's funny.
I hope I don't ever meet you in person or something to that nature.
Investigating or making inquiries of a cold case murder is not a great way to meet people.
Yeah. In fact, that guy had another history with fire. I think he had at least one, maybe even two, you know, small restaurants that had burned down so you could collect insurance money.
How convenient.
I know.
There's a pattern in this man's life of burning things he doesn't want anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I know you don't want to see yourself as an armchair detective, Blue, but what's your sense of how many people would you put on a short list of suspects?
Seven. Yeah. Seven.
It's funny. You've clearly thought about this. You didn't even hesitate.
Yeah, out of that seven, until just a few months ago, three of them were incarcerated. One has since been released from prison in Florida, was living in a halfway house, and I think he's since been released from that, so he's back out there. But other guys, the other people on the list, yeah, have all served prison time, except for Golden Boy, who got off scot-free, and maybe one other guy, you know, both informants for the police.
Mm-hmm. Do you think your contacts in law enforcement would agree with your assessment that seven people deserve to be on the short list?
Maybe not all seven. Maybe four or five of them. Yeah, I mean, they're not going to tell me.
Right. No, I understand that. I understand that. But your sense is.
I think they would concur.
Right. And do you feel like all seven have been looked at appropriately?
Not at all. Definitely not.
Wow. What makes you say that?
Just a hunch, really. I mean, just the fact that I don't know if they followed up on any of the leads that we provided in recent years. You know, after Thomas Holsinger retired, there was really nobody left full time in the cold case, and came up with the information about the out of towner guy confessing to me that he was in Donna's apartment and sold her drugs that night, although be it a small amount of marijuana. You know, not any huge thing, but connecting that to other people that were partying and doing heavier drugs and knew that Donna had the money, you know, they got to look into that more. Get people talking, turn them on each other, something. They need to be a little more creative.
If you had to narrow the seven down any further, would you ever be willing to do that? Or do you feel like do you know enough to say, I think it could be these three guys or anything like that?
I don't know enough, and that's not my job. I'm not trained for this type of thing. You know, there was another guy. I'm going to call him Doughboy, a football player. You know, we talked about him briefly, but this guy was... there was a witness that came forward about some people that were hanging out in those woods, doing some four-wheel driving, you know, off-roading, the weekend before the murders, and she couldn't remember his name. So I got together with Holsinger at one point and started showing her pictures of people, and she said, "That's the guy." And she just couldn't remember his name. And I'm like, "Oh, that's interesting." And it wasn't until about maybe 6 months later that I found out this guy had moved pretty soon after the murders, or was in the process of moving, you know, his family moving out of the area during the murders, had tried to buy a gun to, you know, murder his mom because his mom just couldn't deal with his abundant drug use. He was out of control, this guy. And right. So this gun store owner refused to sell him a gun, sold him a knife instead. And when he was speeding back to his home to maybe assault his mother, I don't know, got pulled over, or attempted to pull over. It was a felony pursuit ensued. And it took 5 law enforcement officers to subdue this guy. And he ultimately went in front of a judge and was found guilty and sentenced to Central State for the criminally insane, where he served his entire sentence. Now, this guy was very outgoing. He was in, I think it was my class at Douglas Freeman, along with Donna. And very outgoing guy, you know, big personality. Evidently, lives as a recluse now. Doesn't talk to many people. Lives on the Eastern Shore.
Do you recall?
I don't think he talked to him at all.
Do you recall what?
I get the hunch he saw something that changed his life that weekend.
And do you recall what he was thrown in jail for?
I don't know the exact charges. I can't remember.
Strange.
Yeah, they need to talk to him for sure.
So, if our listeners want to get involved with this case somehow, how would you recommend that they do that? Should they hang out on your Facebook group? What are your recommendations for people who want to get involved?
Well, if it's people that have information, my first advice or plea would be to contact the police department, Henrico County Police Department. I don't have the number in front of me, but
we'll
give them everything. If it's you know, true crime people, have them join our Facebook group. You know, we love more attention to keep this case in the public eye. It's Justice for Donna Hall and Mike Margaret. You can find it on Facebook. You'll have to apply and wait for an acceptance, but, you know, there's no, like, questions you have to answer or anything. We just ask you to be respectful if you post, and that's basically it.
We'll add the phone number for the Henrico Police Department to our show notes here so that if people have any information, they'll know how to contact the detectives in charge of the case. And if someone wanted to contact you, would they do that through the Justice for Donna Hall and Mike Margaret Facebook page?
Yes, that's the best way to get a hold of me.
Okay. And don't call you Eric. Is that one of the requirements?
Yeah, I've never gone by Eric.
So it's Blue Hall. And then your fellow administrators are also reachable via that page.
Oh, yeah. We get requests all the time, you know, tips. Rob Holland is our administrator. He's willing to help. Tim Cook is the administrator. So, yeah, you can reach out to any of those guys or all three of us.
Mm-hmm. I like the fact that you don't have any trick questions. It's funny, I'm asked to join Facebook groups frequently, and then, of course, they've got all these questions for you. Like, you know, they want to know that you know something about whatever the topic is for that Facebook page. It saddens me. No one ever asks my personal favorite question, are you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party? I just, you know, I think somebody's got to have a sense of history here with the Joe McCarthy hearings.
Yeah, right.
It's my favorite question and no one ever asks.
Yeah, I'll run that by the other admins, see if we can add it.
All right. maybe not, as the case may be. Well, Blue, we really appreciate all of your time, and with your kind permission, we may impose on you again to ask more questions about the murder of Donna Hall and Mike Margaret.
Absolutely. I'm glad to help, and thank you guys for allowing me to tell their stories. You know, Mike and Donna deserve to have this case solved. Their families deserve it. You know, I can't imagine being in that position, having a loved one taken like that. Hopefully one day, guys, you know, they'll figure it out.
Hopefully. Thank you so much, Blue. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Join us again on Mind Over Murder next time as we are joined by retired Henrico Police Department Detective Thomas Holsinger to discuss the Donna Hall Mike Margaret case. We'll look forward to seeing you then.
Mind Over Murder is a production of Absolute Zero and Another Dog Productions.
Our executive producers are Bill Thomas and Kristen Dilley.
Our logo art is by Pamela Arnois.
Our theme music is by Kevin MacLeod.
Mind Over Murder is distributed in partnership with Crawl Space Media.
You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram.
You can also follow our page on the Colonial Parkway Murders on Facebook.
And finally, you can follow Bill Thomas on Twitter at BillThomas56.
Thank you for listening to Mind Over Murder.